impeding the path of immigrants, throwing up roadblocks that allow immigrants to come to the United States, is going to create some real economic problems in the future.
This is Civios, your source for public affairs research. A podcast from the Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota.
In this episode, we are talking with Ryan Allen, an associate professor of community and economic development in the urban and regional planning area at the Humphrey School of Public Affairs. His research focuses on the community and economic development issues of immigrants in the United States. We will be discussing the relationship between proposed immigration policy changes and the potential economic effects. Given some of the recent policy debates underway at the federal level, we felt it was a good time to have this discussion. Welcome, Ryan.
Thanks for having me.
To begin with, can you talk a little bit about your background and why you undertook this research?
Sure. So my background is that I'm trained broadly as an urban planner. I focus on housing and community development issues. But as a graduate student, when I was looking at how metropolitan areas and cities in particular, but also increasingly rural areas of the United States, we're changing demographically, it seemed clear to me that we needed to focus much more intensely on immigrants and what their experience was like in the U.S. So that's how I got into this kind of research, and it's really just gone from there.
So can you talk a little bit more about how has the flow and the composition of immigrants to the United States changed over the last century?
So at the turn of the 20th century, we were still receiving the vast majority of our immigrants from Europe. Western, Eastern, Southern Europe by that time. Today, fast forward over 100 years, and there's been an about-face, right? We've got now immigration is largely coming from Latin America and Asia to the United States. And that kind of major transition deserves some kind of explanation. So initially, the excess kind of labor capacity in Europe at the turn of the 19th century was finding America as a home because of the Industrial Revolution that was going on here, and a variety of changes in transportation technology that made it easier and more affordable to come to the U.S. That didn't last forever, though, right? So once upon a time in America, there were very few restrictions on who could come in. That changed starting in the 1880s when we started to exclude Asians from coming to the United States. And there was a broader set of changes in 1924 that installed some quotas on different countries about how many people we would admit in any given year. Now, those were largely seen today as being very racist in terms of their orientation. It tended to favor Northern Europe over other parts of Europe, for example. And it, as I've already mentioned, we were excluding Asia altogether. But those were the quotas that were put into place. And then, of course, we had some major geopolitical conflicts, the World Wars. We had a Great Depression. And during that era, immigration to the United States virtually came to a screeching halt. It was not a major flow coming into the U.S. after 1924 and going all the way to 1965. By 1965, however, there was a major policy change that occurred in the U.S. We abolished some of those national origin quotas. We instead created hemispheric caps for the first time, hemispheric caps. And we opened up immigration from Asia and Latin America in ways that hadn't been opened before. On top of all that, after the Second World War, we had the Marshall Plan going on in Europe. And for many people who might have been interested in immigrating, there was really no reason to anymore, right? Because now with that kind of investment going on in Europe and the reconstruction effort after the war, it wasn't as attractive to go all the way to the United States when there was enough going on economically at home. However, in Latin America and Asia, there was a lot of pressures the U.S. became a very attractive place to go. So that helps explain why we had that major transition.
Can you talk a little bit historically about the immigration picture, specifically in Minnesota?
Sure. In Minnesota, we actually have a fascinating history when it comes to immigration. So as late as 1900, almost a third of the state residents were foreign-born, right? And that's an astounding number. We were close to the top in terms of the states and their proportion of their populations that were foreign-born. If you included the kids of immigrants in our state, it was over half, really, of the residents of our state were foreign-born. That changed dramatically over the next 100 years, right? So we went from a front runner in terms of the proportion of our population that was an immigrant to really lagging the United States overall. So today, in the Minnesota population, we have about 8% of our residents are foreign-born, compared to about 13.5% for the U.S. overall.
So as you talk about the what has changed for the flow and the composition of immigrants, both in the United States and specifically in Minnesota, can you talk a little bit about the economic and policy factors that precipitated these changes and put that in context a little bit for us?
Sure. So some of the factors that are important for the U.S. overall have already kind of come out a little bit in our conversation, right? So we had this major policy change in 1965. We have a shifting economy that's moving away from manufacturing and towards a service sector, retail sector. And immigrants have became increasingly important for filling some of those kinds of positions in our economy. We went on post-1965 in the United States overall to only make marginal changes really to the immigration policy. Closer home in Minnesota, we see a similar kind of trajectory, right? We're starting to move away in 1965 from resource extraction, right? Mining and logging and agriculture are becoming less important for the state economy. And we have a rise in the service economy, right? Mirroring what was going on in the U.S. overall. And so that helps explain what was going on in Minnesota. Another wrinkle to the immigration story when it comes to Minnesota, though, is how important Minnesota is as a receiver of refugees. So particularly in the late 1970s and into the 80s, Minnesota, because of its really strong nonprofit sector, its really strong Lutheran church infrastructure, became an important resettlement state for refugees. Initially, that meant refugees from Vietnam and especially from Laos, right? We have one of the largest populations of Hmong immigrants in all of the United States right here in Minnesota. Now, as there have been different kind of geopolitical conflicts that have created more refugees in the world, Minnesota has maintained that status as an important resettlement location, right? So whether it be Somalis coming to the state in the mid-1990s or before them, Bosnians, all the way through to other refugee streams like Karen refugees of today, of circa 2018, we remain a really important site for refugee resettlement. And that has been reflected in our profile of immigrants in this state, right? So, for example, in comparison to the U.S. overall, about 25% of our immigrants in the in Minnesota are Latino. At the U.S. level, it's half, right? But on in contrast, just over 1 in 5 of the immigrants in Minnesota today are from Africa, in comparison to more like 5 or 6% in the U.S. overall. Right. So that's a direct reflection of the refugee resettlement program we have here.
What role do you anticipate immigrants playing in the future population and workforce of both the United States and Minnesota specifically?
One of the demographic developments that we've seen in the U.S. overall is not news to anyone, and that is an aging population, right? When we have the baby boomers moving out of the workforce and into retirement years, we've seen our population in the United States get older. Some of the existing research on immigration suggests that as we've received more and more immigrants in the United States, that's been a really welcome development because we need people to move in to the workforce to fill some of those jobs, right? So to that point, in the state of Minnesota, right, we have one of the older states in the United States. And when we look at who's moving out of the workforce and the aging population around the state and who's going to come in to take those jobs, it seems pretty clear that the immigrants are going to play a large role in that. Now, how large remains to be seen depending upon different immigration policies that we're considering today, right, and what effect that'll have on future immigration to the state. But if we just assume for a minute a constant state, right, that the immigrants that we've been receiving for the past several years, we continue at roughly that rate, right, we can anticipate that virtually all of the growth in our labor force here in the state of Minnesota will be due to immigrants, Right? Now, that's quite a statement. And by the way, it's largely the case also in the United States that immigrants are going to play a disproportionate impact in the changes to our labor force going forward. Right? Most of the growth is going to come from them. That's a function of an aging native-born population and lower fertility rates among native-born residents of the United States. So for those reasons, both at the U.S. level and in Minnesota, immigrants are going to play an outsized role. A lot remains to be seen about exactly what that role will look like, because there have been a lot of debate recently about what our immigration policy should be.
So when we think about the work that they're doing and going to be doing, can you talk a little bit about the factors that will help explain why immigrants tend to concentrate in specific industries within the economy?
Absolutely. So it's been a well-understood facet of the economy when it comes to immigrants that over time they've tended to concentrate in different kinds of industries. So that's happened throughout the history of the United States. When we look today, though, at where immigrants tend to concentrate in the economy, or we can look more specifically at the state of Minnesota, it tends to be in relatively few industries. So we can find large proportions of immigrant workers in construction. We can find large proportions of immigrant workers in restaurants and hospitality. But we also, and that's on the lower end of the skills spectrum, or the semi-skilled in terms of construction industry, but we also see a disproportionate presence of immigrants at the upper end of the skills spectrum, right? So think of our Fortune 500 companies here in the state of Minnesota and what proportion of their workforces, be they engineers or IT professionals or doctors, are foreign-born. It's a large proportion of their workforce. Now, why that would happen is certainly related to the skills that immigrants bring, but it also has something to do with how immigrants are hired. When you do research about how people actually go about hiring when they have vacancies, one of the important sources of information about new people to hire comes from word of mouth, right? So if you hire, let's say, a new immigrant to work on a construction workforce crew, and you have vacancies, which tends to happen in construction, there's a large amount of turnover that happens. It's certainly not unheard of. In fact, it's likely that you'll ask the existing workers for recommendations on who might come to fill those positions. And so as that kind of referral continues, you have this virtuous cycle where you can start to see more and more immigrants inhabiting particular industries. So when you think about the Twin Cities, for example, taxis and Ubers, right, are starting to become dominated by immigrants. The construction industry and restaurants, similar around the United States, but also true in the Twin Cities and Minnesota in general, dominated by immigrants. Agricultural work, be it picking crops, be it animal processing, tend to be disproportionately populated with immigrant workers.
Going a little bit further with that, can you talk about what your research tells us about the effect of immigrant workers on the wages of people born in the United States?
Well, this is a really hot button topic, right? It's been debated for decades, if not longer, in the United States, because the simple economic logic of increasing the supply of labor most people tend to believe that that's going to depress wages, right? It's just about the theory of supply and demand. The best research we see on this, right, in fact, the National Academies report that came out last year that has become a somewhat definitive source for understanding what effect immigrants have on wage structures, suggests that in the aggregate, there's actually very little effect. Right, and what effect we do observe tends to be at the very low end of the wage spectrum. Right, so think about the kinds of jobs that people that don't have a high school degree would assume in the workforce. What the existing research tells us is that if there is a depressive effect of immigrants on wages, it tends to be there. So why there would be such a limited depressive effect of immigrants on the wage structure deserves explanation. One potential explanation is that people don't think about immigrants as also inducing demand, right? So that is, in addition to coming and looking for jobs, they're also doing things like shopping in our restaurants and our shopping malls. They're demanding housing. That creates a stimulus for the demand of housing, which stimulates construction, et cetera, right? So there's this multiplier effect that immigrants bring on the demand side as well as the supply side. You also have to think about immigrants and what kind of workers they're likely to be substitutes for, right? So particularly in low-skill, low-wage immigrants, low-skill immigrants that are likely to earn low wages, their English skills are not going to be fluent, right? And so you have to think about what kind of workers are most substitutable for them. Whose jobs are they going to be threatening, right, to use the kind of rhetoric that we sometimes hear among politicians? And the general consensus among most academics is that those kinds of immigrants are not great substitutes for most American workers, right? Anytime you have to deal with customer interaction, you need to speak English for the most part in the United States. So that helps explain why there's such a muted kind of effect on wages. The debate is not over. Certainly politically, it's not over. Among economists, though, I think there tends to be a much greater level of consensus, right, that these kinds of effects on wages are relatively minor.
So what can you say, then, that your research tells you about the net fiscal effects of immigrants in the federal system?
Right. Also another hot-button issue politically in the United States. So the question becomes, how much taxes do immigrants pay, and what are they taking in terms of public benefits, right? That's the essential calculus that happens when you're asking about the fiscal effects of immigrants in the U.S. And it's a deceptively complex analysis, right? So if we think about, well, one thing that academics have come to some agreement upon is if you only look narrowly, like if we just look at the next 5 years, right, that's really an insufficient way of tackling that question because most people agree that you have to think about it generationally. So let me give you an example. We have new immigrants that come to the United States. They tend to be distributed across the educational attainment spectrum in either the low end or the high end, very few in the middle, right? So to make that more concrete, a large proportion of immigrants that either have a high school degree or less, and also a large proportion of immigrants that have bachelor's degrees or more, right? So they tend to be at those two ends of the spectrum. But more of them tend to be at the lower end. And so that means that they are earning less money and therefore contributing lower taxes than kind of your median native-born resident in the U.S. It also is true, though, that for many of these immigrants, they're not able to access a lot of the public benefits that a lot of native-born residents would be able to access. That's particularly true if they're here without authorization. All right, so we have now this calculus where they're not contributing much in taxes, those at the lower end of the wage spectrum, but they're also not eligible for a lot of the public benefits with one exception, and that is public education. Right? And that's also tends to be one of the most expensive kinds of public benefits that we offer in the United States. So when you start to do this arithmetic, initially immigrants are very costly, and it's largely because their kids are educated in our public school systems. And if you include that as a cost, right, that in the first generation, the costs tend to outweigh the benefits is what the research tells us. However, by the second and certainly by the third generation, the exact opposite is happening. Right? Those investments in public education for their kids paying off. The second generation tends to rapidly assimilate in terms of the kinds of wages they earn. They tend to, even though they're eligible for the benefits, tend to use the public benefits less. And they have the exact opposite calculus that's going on by the second and certainly by the third generations. So that if you look at a longer time horizon, unambiguously, there's a net gain for the United States fiscally from immigrants. The other wrinkle that you have to discuss here is the spatial distribution, though. Right? So a lot of those benefits come through the federal income tax structure. So that means at the national level, there may be these enormous benefits for the country overall. However, when it comes to state and local levels, you can still see some fiscal drag when it comes to immigrants, right? So the costs of immigration may be borne more at the local or state level, while the benefits of immigration may accrue at the national level. And that is a really important discussion, a policy discussion for us to have as a country.
We spent a fair amount of time talking about the economic impacts of immigration in our society. I think it's important now to talk about how the increased diversity that immigrants have brought to the U.S. over the past several decades has changed local societies. So can you talk a little bit about that, too?
Absolutely. the kinds of immigrant streams that we've seen since 1965 and onwards have been the engine of diversification in the United States in terms of race and ethnicity. Once upon a time in the United States, diversity in terms of race meant thinking about different European groups, right? In the late 1800s and early 1900s, before the Irish were perhaps considered white, before Jews were considered white, that was what we meant by racial diversification in addition to African Americans. In a post-1965 world, however, it's changed dramatically. So now we have much more attention to Latino, to Asian, to pan-ethnic Asian identity, pan-Latino identity, to go along with the kind of more historical racial dichotomy we have in the United States, which was about whites and African Americans. So that's one way of thinking about the kind of increased diversification that we see in societies all around the United States now. Immigration has been the engine of that diversification. But there are other kinds of diversity that immigrants have brought, with religion being an important one. Right. So again, once upon a time, diversification religion meant Protestants, Catholics, and Jews. Right. And while that's still certainly an important distribution of religions in the United States, add to that Islam, Buddhists, Confucianists, etc. Right. A lot of these world religions are now very much at home in the United States. They're at home in our local communities. So that's another kind of diversification. And it's one that, frankly, has led to some consternation among some. We've seen really clearly rises in levels of discomfort and people speaking out and fearful about Islam in particular in a post-9/11 world in the U.S. And so coming to grips with that kind of diversity in our communities, both racial and ethnic, religious, socioeconomic, there are many layers of this diversity that we are still addressing as societies.
So, Ryan, what are the policy implications of the research you're doing?
So one of the major policy implications is that in the future, if we're going to be mostly reliant on immigrants for increasing our workforce, for population growth, at the nation overall, and certainly within different states and metropolitan areas and rural areas and states, if that, while not being a certainty, is our best understanding of how the future looks for our population and workforce, then that suggests that impeding the path of immigrants, throwing up roadblocks that allow immigrants to come to the United States, is going to create some real economic problems in the future, right? That's one clear implication from the research that I've done and what many others have done. So, for example, in the state of Minnesota, the projections indicate that our labor force is going to grow at about 0.5% per year on average. If we want that to increase, and that's historically a very low number, right? We've more typically been over 1% growth per year in our labor force. If we want that to grow, and there's good reasons for us to want that to grow because it's an essential component to economic growth for our state, if we want that to grow, we're going to have to attract more migrants to the state, whether that be international migrants or whether that be domestic migrants. The troubling trend, though, is that we're actually losing more of our native-born residents than we're gaining, right? More people tend to leave the state of Minnesota than move here from other states. And so we're going to have to rely on international immigrants. And if instead of increasing the flow of international immigrants, we're reducing it, that's going to have an enormous impact on our labor force and potentially a large impact on the kinds of economic growth we expect in the state.
Thank you for listening to another podcast from Civios, an initiative of the Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota. To learn more about this segment, please visit civios.umn.edu.